distinguished university scholar and professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. In 2012, he was visiting Lisa Hume, research professor in aesthetics at Warwick, working with Dermot, and at the time, he was writing a book that was published last year with Oxford University Press called Beyond Art, and he's got a book coming out next year, I think, Four Arts of Photography, of which this is a taster, and he's Bouche, I've been told, and the title of the talk is Abstract Photography. So please join me in welcoming Dom.
I hope to persuade you that the bloated theory of photography is a good idea. And yes, in answer to the historian's question earlier on, in my own case, I can attest that recent developments in photography have been a motivation for me. They have been sort of driving my theorizing and thinking about photography. So I'm going to tell you a bit about abstract photography today. It's in the book, but I'm going to make some connections that I don't make in the book because I have this kind of methodological rigor in the book, this isolation strategy, I call it. I'm going to drop that here. You may not have realized that I have been showing you for the last couple of minutes a photograph by Fox Talbot, said to be one of the inventors of photography. You probably have seen some of the first images, photographic images that he made. The lattice window, the lace. These, you might think, are good cases of abstract photography. It's kind of interesting that 20 years later, he's still making these abstract photographs, three sheets of gauze, 1852. Let's say in the next century, there's a Man Ray abstract photograph. So there's been abstract photography for a long time. More recently, there's a Shereen Gill. She's in London, is that right? Anybody know? Abstract photography has been around for a long time. Maybe for much of that time, you could fairly say that it was a marginal or specialized phenomenon. I think that's changed today. There's a great deal of abstract photography being made. So, first task that I would like to tackle is the task of determining what the right question to ask is, what an interesting thesis to argue for might be. You might think that we should set our sights on making a case for the claim that there are abstract photographs. And of course, the old theories of photography, the old GIF theory of photography, might deny that. The narrow belt of theory of photography might deny that. Here's another claim that you might think is interesting to try to establish: some abstract photographs are works of art. I'm going to try for something a little bit more ambitious. I'd like to try to persuade you that there is an art of abstract photography. And the idea here is that there are features that make some photographs abstract. And those very same features are the features that make them photographs. So they're non-incidentally works of abstract photographic art. Or if you want to think of this another way, there is abstract photography by nature. By the nature of photography, photographic abstraction is grounded in what it is to be a photograph. So something needs to be said about what it is to be a photograph. So how are we going to approach this? Well, I'm going to do a little bit of work with this argument. I'll step you through the argument in just a second, but I'd like to say a couple of things about the argument first. For the philosophers of photography in the room, you may think that I'm giving a reconstruction of the Scruton argument, and I'm not sure that I am. The more important thing to say is that I think that this argument is more interesting than Scruton's argument because the elements of this argument go all the way back to the earliest days of photography and the earliest days of thinking about photography. So one of the things that I do in Four Arts of Photography, the book is actually to begin with a history, and I extract these elements of this argument from that history. So first of all, let's begin with the idea that a pure photograph is an image that depicts in this special way. Garrett's told you all about it. I talk about belief-independent feature tracking. This idea is equivalent to belief-independent kind of factual dependence or indexicality or mind-independent. Blah, blah, blah. So you've got the idea of it, right? Okay, if that's true, then we can't take an interest in a photograph as a depictively expressed thought. And Darwin also talked about that. A third idea is that images are representational artworks only if you can take an interest in them when they do express thoughts by means of depiction. Five, photography is an art only if some photographs are representational artworks. That's to say, they do appeal to our interest in depictively expressed thoughts. So photography is not an art. Ernie Sosa, philosopher, American philosopher, says some arguments should have their premises examined. And this is an argument that should have its premises examined. Why? Well, here's some observations. First, six is false. I just take it for granted as a starting point that six is false. This is a big difference between the old theory and the new theory. Newer theorists are not fretting about six at all. So, six is just false. We have no idea. But for those of you in the room who are, don't worry, it's okay. Photography is not. That's not really the reason why I'm looking at this argument. Secondly, this is what we in philosophy call a deductively valid argument. This means that if the premises 1 through 5 are true, then the conclusion 6 has got to be true. And since 6 is false, we can infer that at least one of the premises is false. Thirdly, I think a good case can be made that every premise in this argument is false. So there are unsound arguments, but unsound arguments that are completely unsound are kind of unusual. Another observation, the argument has legs. I just told you that it goes all the way back to the 1840s. So it keeps percolating up in thinking about, or elements do, in thinking about photography. So this is wild for a philosopher. You have an argument that's completely unsound that seems to have a real grip on it. And I think this means that we can work with this argument. We can use this argument to do some work. Okay? By the way, this notion of a pure photograph, don't think of that, don't moralize that. All that that means is, if photography is an art, then we're interested in the idea that photographs can be art just by using the resources of photography. And so a good way to test whether photography can be an art by using the resources of photography is just by looking at photographs that only use the resources of photography and don't mix in any techniques for any other arts. So this is just a little bit of logical rigor. That's all that's going on there. Don't moralize as much as you hear it. If we're interested in abstract photographs, we'll probably think that they come in if we think that 5 is false. 5 says photography is an art only if some pure photographs are representational artworks. Presumably abstract photographs are non-representational, and if my thesis is true, the one that I'm going for is true, then there's art of abstract photography. So, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes explaining this, and then talk about other elements of the argument, and then come back to 5. Okay, one thing to notice that a representational artwork isn't simply a work that 1 is art plus 2 is representational. Rather, it's got to be an artwork that is art because of its representationality. Its representational character factors in to making it a work of art. The other thing that I'd like to mention is that, if I can get the slide to change, so with that in mind, you might think that if 5 is false, then photography, so this is true, photography is an art, and this is false. That's what would make a conditional false. And the antecedent is true, and its consequence is false. So photography is an art, but there are some pure photographs that are non-representational. They're non-representational art. And in fact, the old theorists of photography were quite happy to admit this. They were quite happy to say, of course you can set aside the representational character of art, of photographs, And you can view them as formal constructions. And those formal constructions can be quite interesting. There's a kind of a music in the imagery. But that is not what we're really interested in. And I want to accept that. I think that the old theorists are right in suggesting that this is too easy. This is too easy a way to argue for the claim that there's an art of abstract photography. Here's just an anecdote to make vivid why I think this. So you are probably all familiar with Robert Mapplethorpe's X Portfolio. That's, of course, not an image from the X Portfolio. You can now imagine, if you've seen it, what the X Portfolio looks like. And it got into trouble in a city in Ohio called Cincinnati about 20 years ago. And there was a court case, and the court was asked to determine whether or not Mapplethorpe's photographs were obscene. And there were witnesses called to testify, including curators and historians and critics. And one of them, who was talking about these images, said, well, I call them bigger studies. It's all about symmetry and order in classical composition. And here she's talking about a photograph that shows a finger inserted into a penis. And she says, subject matter is unimportant, what matters is technique. And I think, okay, this might be terrific courtroom strategy, and maybe the defense lawyers should be congratulated, but it really is missing the point of the X Portfolio. Here's David Hickey. It's insane or morally ignorant to expect or even desire a beholder to confront these passionate, partisan, and political celebrations of marginality and not respond to the subject, which deals so intimately with trust, pain, love, and the giving up of the self. I think that's exactly right. This is the sense in which to say photography is an art because in the sense that we can just focus on the formal beauties of photographs and neglect their representational character is missing the point, and that's a throwaway concession. Okay. So it's a throwaway concession, but in addition to that, it also does not work well with one. Right? So I want to argue that abstract photographs are works of photographic art in virtue of exploiting the resources of photographs, of photography, in virtue of there being photographs. Their artistic status is grounded in the nature of photography. But one says the nature of photography is this kind of imaging that tracks future independently of belief. So the deeper problem with the throwaway concession is that it clashes with one. So we've got to look at the nature of photography together with our interest in the formal features of photographs at the same time. Okay, let me go back. So, what I'm going to do in order to, and this is something I don't do in the book, but I'd like to kind of like test it out on you here. I'd like to think about what we can learn from the argument as a whole about abstract photography. So, here's the strategy of the book. It's four arts of photography. What are these four arts? Well, you'll notice that it's an argument that's completely unsound, so all of the premises are false. And there are four substantive premises. Four premises that add new information. They're premises 1, 2, 3, and 5. So each art of photography you can imagine as standing up to one of these premises. So abstract photographs stand up to premise 5. So there are the photographs that you could say disprove, though I'm not interested in disproving 5, because I already know 5 is false. Right? That's where I started. But you can understand them as filling, putting meat on the bones of the falsity of 5. Right? So one way to approach abstract photographs is just to think about 5, where 5 goes wrong, and to assume that the rest of the argument is true. And that's kind of the rigorous. But I like to kind of relax that method. And so what I'd like to do is take a look at what we can learn about abstract photographs by looking at other arts of photography, where those other arts of photography stand up to other premises in this argument. So let's look at three. It says, when you have a representational artwork, then you have an interest in an artwork as expressing a thought potentially. And if that's false, then we have some representational artworks that are art, but their being art is not grounded in their depicting a thought in they're expressing a thought in depictive form. So there's no thought going on here, nothing that merits the heavy use of the word thought. And I think that photographs like this fall nicely, they coordinate nicely with what we think of as modernist photography. So here is Henri Cartier-Bresson's Valencia, 1933. And it gives you a visual experience. It gives you a visual experience of a scene that you might, if you were around in 1933, encounter. But it shows you that scene as looking in a way that you would probably not see it as looking if you did encounter it. In fact, you may have walked past scenes similar to this. So in our visual world, there are backgrounds and foregrounds. We tend not to attend to backgrounds and foregrounds. We tend also not to attend to the two-dimensional features of these backgrounds and foregrounds as if they were collapsed onto a plane. And this is what the Cartier-Bresson gives us. It gives us this kind of like spooky, eerie juxtaposition of background and foreground all lined up in this almost sort of abstract way. So we have what we have here is a photograph of a scene showing the world as looking quite unfamiliar. And that unfamiliarity is bound up with its two-dimensional formal composition. Right? Thought? I don't think so. What's interesting in this photograph is the visual experience it gives you. And I think that there's an art of photography that is about visual experience. Just about visual experience. Rigorously about visual experience. So here's another example, taking the same idea and pushing it a little bit towards abstraction. This is Imogen Cunningham's leaf pattern. And you see leaves. And you know, you see leaves all the time. This is what leaves look like. In a way, it's kind of humdrum. You're not being told anything new and surprising. But leaves don't normally look like this. They don't normally look like this because we don't normally see them flattened out in this way. We don't normally see the close-tone printing that Cunningham is using here. We don't normally see leaves as having those fine gradations of those 50,000 shades of gray. Okay, so again, here's what's interesting in this photograph. It gives you a visual experience of a familiar world as looking unfamiliar. That's the first art of photography, but it partly does this by taking advantage of the two-dimensional formal, compositional, and chromatic features of photography. Okay, so that's one art of photography. There's another art of photography that you can view as kind of standing up to the second premise in this argument. So this premise says, if you have a pure photograph, then it has got to be a photograph that that does not promote an interest in a depictively expressed thought. And so the second art of photography is going to be made up of images that are helpfully understood as depicting by belief-independent future tracking. So they're like good documents, solid documentary photographs. And they get the intellective powers of the mind going. Here's an example, Douglas Hubler, duration pieces. So duration piece number 11, here's what he does, it's Central Park, I think. He finds a Schwab, he randomly takes a Schwab, there's a Schwab, sets up his camera, looks at his watch, every 15 minutes he takes a shot. So it's a series of shots at the shrub, taking 15 minutes. It's good documentation of a shrub at 15-minute intervals in Central Park. It's not visually interesting, I can tell you. So it's not like in the first arc. But there's some thoughts here about agency and process and the nature of art that are being invoked. Dharma gave some examples. Jeff Wall, for instance, is a documentation of a scene. It involves a little bit of trickery, but we're supposed to see it as good documentation of a scene, and it's expressing thoughts about maybe the Jericho or trickery photography or the relationship or photography's place in the history of art and painting, things like that. I don't think we can learn too much about abstract photography from this particular art, so let me move on to the third art. And this is where the bloated theory of photography comes in. So the skeptic's argument, the argument that I've got up on the screen, is anchored in this conception of photography that is, as Darwin said, really crafted to address our epistemic interests, our epistemic concerns concerning photography. I do think that it makes sense to think about maybe setting aside or contextualizing or limiting our epistemic interests in photography and thinking about the artistic potential that photography holds. So, where's one coming from? I'd like to step you towards the bloated theory of photography, the new theory of photography. Where's it coming from? Well, one thing to say about it is it does, as Darwin said, it relies on a disjoint conception of drawing, where drawing and photography, it wants pure photography and pure drawing not to overlap. They can't overlap. And that allows that in actual photographs, they may in fact overlap. So somebody like Scruton can say, yeah, of course some photographs are works of art, but that's because they're made partly by taking advantage of the techniques of drawing. They're hybrids of drawing and photography. And they have a mixed parentage. One parent is photography, the other parent is drawing, and they inherit their art genes from the drawing parent. Okay? So it's being drawings that makes them works of art. So purity is playing an important role here because it's forcing us to separate out what makes an image a photograph and what makes an image a drawing. And then our challenge is to come up with a conception of photography on which photographs can be works of art and without worrying too much about the old theory of photography. So what I'm saying is that paired with the theory of photography is the theory of drawing. If we say a photograph is an image that depicts by a belief-independent feature tracking, then a drawing is an image that depicts by belief-dependent feature tracking. So that's the idea. The work that one is doing to get you to the skeptical conclusion that photography is not an art requires this disjoint conception of photography and drawing. That's the purity there is telling us that. We need to understand pure drawing in a way that's distorted from pure photography. So that's the idea. Okay? So now, there's two strategies you can have to arrive at the new theory of photography. One is to focus on a lot of photographs. Another is to take a look at drawing. And I think it's important to do both. And I have a couple of issues with this theory of drawing. One is that I think it over-intellectualizes the drawing process. It's as if, like, drawing is like doing math in the head or something. Like, you observe the world, you form beliefs about it, you figure out, okay, given that the world looks like that, what marks do I need to make, right? It's all going through the belief system, And I think that anybody who draws understands that it's embodied, that it's muscle memory, that it's feedback from the eye-hand coordination, right? And that a lot of it bypasses the belief system. It's a skill. A skill is a competence acquired through repeated trying. You try over and over and over again until you get it, and that just tells you that it's bypassing. So what if drawing is depicted by ritually embodied mark making? Then maybe D is not quite right. And also, what if you can draw in a way that that does involve belief independent future tracking? So here's a way to think about this. Can you make a drawing and make a discovery by making that drawing? If the answer is yes, then it must be that your drawing is involved some belief independent, because you don't discover what you already believe. You can't discover what you already believe. So belief independent picture tracking. So my idea is that this theory of drawing is too narrow. And if we have the right theory of drawing, we're going to see that we're not going to be able to sustain a disjoint conception of pure photography and pure drawing. Okay. So what does the new theory of photography look like? I'd just like to acknowledge its source. I think it comes originally from Patrick Maynard. Although he doesn't describe it in the same way as some of us have. But he thinks of photography as a branching family of technologies whose common stem is simply the physical marking of surfaces through the agency of light and similar radiation. So the idea here is, first, there's a hint that there are some stages. Second, there's the idea that there's a stage that involves light. And third, there's the idea that there's a stage that involves marking. Now, Dawn really articulated, here she is. It's the first person who articulates this. This is the only picture of you on the web. Everybody uses it. We need to get on Instagram. Upload some photographs. So she suggests that photography is a multi-stage process for creating marked or differentiated surfaces. Now, she and I have our theories differ a little bit because we have different stages, and so we can argue about, you know, what are the right stages? Philosophers always disagree when they agree. So there you are in Arizona, you come upon the cactus, you think, that's great, I want to go to Facebook or take a picture. And so you snap, you trip the shutter. At the moment of you're tripping the shutter, there's this light image on the film in this case, on the camera back, not on the film. Well, when you trip the shutter, there's a light image on the film. The light image is a moving, it's a three-dimensional image. It's width, height, plus time. So this is important, it's a moving thing. But if you've got a fast shutter speed, you probably just capture a very small fragment of that time dimension. And then there's the recording event. So the information carried in that light image is recorded in the electron state of the emulsion. It's electron states in the emulsion. So the electrons go into a heightened state. And then you need some image processing. As Darwin said, there is no photograph to look at. In fact, if you opened up the camera back to look at the photograph, you would not only be disappointed, but you would destroy your careful work. So you need to produce the photograph, and so you take this emulsion with its heightened electron state, and you run through some chemicals, and the electrons do some business, and then some stuff happens, and you get the artifacts, right? And at the end of the day, you end up with your artifactual image that you can see, that you can look at. Of course, nowadays that doesn't happen so much. Charge couple device, heightened electron states in the individual sensors of the charge couple device is remarkably the same. But there's no image. There is no image. You need to process it. A lot of processing takes place actually in this gizmo here, or in your camera. But even then, that's produced in the RAW file. Then you need to do further processing. If you're lucky enough, in your Apple G4Q. Send it to the print shop, or upload it to a screen. of course, there are all kinds of hybrids. So this is just like a picture of two processes. How many processes are there? Multi-state variants on this multi-state process. There's lots, hundreds, thousands. Some people do hybrid processes. So this is what I do. I prefer to shoot the film, and then I scan the film, and then go from there digitally. So here's my four-stage process. Start with the pro-photographic scene. That's part of photography. Then you get a light image, a photographic recording event, then a mark-making process that produces the visible image. The only element of all of this that is intrinsically distinctive of photography is the photographic recording event. You can define the light image as something that inputs to the photographic recording event, but it's not intrinsically photographic. The same light image is on the back of your eyes right now. Pro-photographic, that's the world. That's not intrinsically photographic. Mark-making processes that are used in photography, even traditional photography, darkroom photography, are used for all kinds of other purposes. Computer chips are made for negatives. Made from film, for instance. So it's a very, very similar, it's that same kind of mark-making process. This is all an information channel. Sorry about that. Okay, information channel. So we have the world that is a source of information, and you have a signaling system that captures, stores, and transmits that information. I think it's useful to think of the four-stage photographic process as an information channel. And here's why. So there's the theory. An image is a photograph. What it is for an image to be a photograph is for it to result from a mark-making process that takes input from an electrochemical event that records information from the projection of a light image of a photographic scene. So this means that drawing and photography are not mutually exclusive because, as Dermot said, you can paint to make the marks that from which information from a recording event are input. So drawing and photography are not mutually exclusive. Now, what does this tell us about how photography can be practiced as an art? Why is it useful to adopt this new theory of photography? If we're going to not worry too much about thinking of photography in epistemic terms, but instead think of it in aesthetic terms, what's the payoff here? Well, there's a photograph by Cartier Hortsfield. It was large on the scale of meters. It was shown along with a number of other works in a show called Slow Time and Present about almost 10 years ago. And it looks pretty much like your standard silver gelatin print, except that it's a digital photograph. He took the digital file and he sent it to a textile mill in Flanders and had it produced as a tapestry. So it's like a big carpet, right, hanging on the wall. And I think that is a photograph where the mark-making process is just not the standard one that we've become used to in photography. And he's making a point here. So there are photographs in this same exhibition that are frescoes. So they're made with inkjet print on wet plaster. The theme of the show, Slow Time and Present, is using obsolete imaging technologies that tend to be associated with the church and the palace in a contemporary context. So there you have somebody who is exploiting the variability of the channel conditions, information channel of photography, in order to achieve some purpose. I call this lyric photography because you have the means being coordinated with the content, just as you do in lyric poetry. The means of the verse and the content of the verse are very closely coupled, And you have the same thing in this kind of photography. Here's another example. There's Gerhard Richter's Betty. And he's doing this for a reason. He says a lot about why he's doing this. And it's clear that the fact that there's a photographic event is essential, and it's clear that the fact that he painted it is essential. And then the question is, how do we square that circle? But it is a circle to be squared, because I don't think you really get the painting if you just think it's a painting made in the regular way from the artist's imagination. And you don't get this if you think it's a photograph taken with a SLR. And just that. So it is both a painting and a photograph. I said Strummett asked if I was going to show James Welling. This is one of his flower series. It's a photogram, so he's taken flower blossoms. These are plumbago blossoms on their stems. Into the dark room, he lays them on the photographic paper. He has a larger that has a box in it for filters, and he's over the years he's produced these little sets of patterns of filters and puts it in the box, and he exposes the plumbago blossoms to this filtered light. And there's an example of what you get. And so this is again an intervention in the information channel from recording event, from pro-photographic scene to light image to recording event to mark-making process. And it's just put it this way, it's about light, and flowers are about light. Flowers are the things that, you know, plants are the things that thrive on light, that eat light. And maybe the flower of the plant is the kind of expression, the giving back of that light to us through color. Okay, so why am I calling these channel conditions? Well, the philosopher Fred Gretzky used this term. He thought it was an important concept. We understand that every information channel has channel conditions. So every information channel carries information about a source, the world. And the channel conditions are the conditions of the channel that add no information about that source. But we can take an interest in the channel conditions. So his example is the speedometer on your car. You're driving along, it shows that you're moving 8 kilometers an hour. There it is, showing that you're moving 8 kilometers an hour. So the speedometer is carrying information about the world, your motion in the world. But you might be interested in whether or not the speedometer is working well. So you might use your GPS to tell you how quickly you're moving. You might see that the speedometer needle is pointing to the right place. And now your interest is not in the world, it's in the device that's carrying information about the world. You're interested in the channel conditions of the device, and you might find that the needle is not pointing where it should be. It's probably needing some calibration. So Gretzky says the channel conditions of a signal are the framework within which communication takes place. They're not the source about which communication takes place. And it seems clear that when it comes to art, we are often interested in both the channel conditions and the source conditions. We're interested in them together. And we're interested in the coordination of the one and the other. In other words, we're interested in both the what and the how. So the thing about the new theory of photography is it gives us an expanded conception of the how in which we can take an interest. And we can take an interest in that how for its own sake, or also in its relation to the what. The traditional theory of photography gives us very little how to work with, and that's why the fake theory is no art. By the way, so all that's essential to intrinsic to photography, in my view, is the photographic event. There's not much scope for intervention in the photographic event, right? So the specialness of photography is there, but it shrinks to a point. So what's interesting in photography, it still makes it photography, are interventions in the other three elements of the process. So photographs can be made to exploit an interest in channel conditions. So remember that I would like to persuade you that there is an art of abstract photography. This is kind of hard to see if we accept the old theory of photography. So I'm suggesting that we replace the old theory of photography with a new theory. And now the new theory says there are these different stages, and you get photographic art. You get art that is photographic by nature, that is grounded in the nature of photography, if you have manipulations of the channel conditions. And there are three stages at which you can have manipulations of the channel conditions. So maybe there can be three different basic ways of practicing the art of abstract photography. Three basic, because these can be combined. So it's actually more. So let's just look at some examples. So I'll say there's abstract photography degree one. I just mean by that that this is these are abstract photographic works that are works of photographic art, abstract photographic art, that we can understand as resulting from a photographic artist tweaking the pro-photographic scene. So this is a Lotte Jacobi, photogenic. I think these are fabrics. It doesn't so much matter, right? Because our interest in this is in the formal, two-dimensional features of the photograph, very beautiful, elegant photograph. Robert had a brother, Edward, kid brother, and he's also a photographer, but he's mostly makes, I think, abstract photographs. And this is made from horsehair. So it's a photogram made from pieces of horsehair. He was carefully arranged on the surface. So there again, you have an example of an abstract photograph made by arranging a pro-photographic scene. Right, so no manipulation and downstream processes. You can move from degree one to degree two. So degree one, abstract photography, involves manipulation of the photographic scene. Degree two involves manipulation of the light image. So these are two photographs from Eileen Quinlan's Night Flight series. And they're made, I can tell you, they're made from shards of glass, broken glass, that have been arranged on light-sensitive material and then exposed. And in this case, she added a filter. So the filter is an intervention in the light image. It's a creation of the light image. It's not the pro-photographic scene, but it's modifying the information from the pro-photographic scene that's being captured in the recording event, where the recording event is a recording event of a light image. Okay, so just to take that a step further, Jessica Eaton is doing something similar. There is an object she's photographed, it's just a white cube. And what she does is she takes multiple exposures using a different filter at each stage. And then she superimposes them. And so this is the result. The white cube is not of much interest to us here. So the pro-photographic scene isn't of much interest to us here. But what is interesting is how she's layered the light image for formal purposes. So one way to get abstraction is by focusing on accentuating the formal. I showed you a Shireen Gill at the beginning. I remember being like 14, 15 and trying this myself. So this is painting with light, but what she does is she actually moves the camera. So it's done. It's not done with like a laser pointer in the dark room, nothing like that. It's actually, she takes the camera, she moves it around. So it's very performative. And I'm thinking that the pro-photographic scene is just stuck there. It's a light source of some kind. And that she's manipulating the light image through a movement of her body. And that's what the kind of drawing comes in. Okay, what about, so photographic recording event is just a capturing of information. That's just the electronic or chemical capturing of information. So not much to do there, but let's move on to the mark-making process. You've probably seen these, Ellen Carey's. They're called Polaroid poles. They're 20 by 24, so it's a large format Polaroid camera. It's 20-inch by 24-inch Polaroid camera. She was making photographs with them one day, and she noticed that if she kept pulling the Polaroid. You all have used a Polaroid. You know how you pull it through the rollers. She noticed that if you kept pulling, you would get these just color patterns. This was the exhausted dyes. And so she thought, okay, what if I just go for the pull? So she exposes the seam so that will control like the hues that you get, the way the dyes react. So there is a light exposure here. But she keeps on pulling the Polaroid and you get more patterns like this. I thought I'd show Wolfgang Tillmans. Again, the same sort of idea here. He's exposed some photographic paper, and he's run it through a very cruddy commercial processing machine. So these machines are supposed to be clean from time to time, and they get cruddy, and he says, okay, let's leave the crud in and see what results you get. So here you have somebody who's, in both of these cases, it's not manipulation of it's not an optical manipulation in the fourth stage. It's a chemical, a wet side manipulation of photography. I've suggested that a good way to think about abstract photography, there being works of photographic art that are works of photographic art, but not because they're works of representational art. A good way to think about that is to replace the old theory of photography with the new theory of photography. And that's because it suggests that we can see, it suggests that there's kind of a structure in the possibility space for abstract photography. If you're going to set about making an abstract photograph, there are these three basic strategies that you can follow. And of course, you can combine them and blend them. And these three basic strategies have countless variants nested within them. What if there's no photographic recording event at all? Okay. Do we still have an abstract photograph? Well, technically the answer is no, because I have a theory of photography that says that you have to have the photographic recording event. And so the answer is no, but as I said earlier on, I think that the purpose of a philosophical theory is not to police our behaviors by saying there's something out there in the world that we must be responsive to. There's some, the artistic nature is carved at some joints and we better stay within the lines. Don't paint beyond the lines. That's not my approach. My approach is this. The point of a theory of photography is to articulate some structure that helps us to explain our practices, our practices of making photographs, our practices of understanding their history, of criticizing photographs, writing about photographs, enjoying photographs. It might draw lines, but the point of the lines isn't to say don't cross them, but just to note that there is a boundary, there is a difference there. But it may not be a difference that makes a huge difference. There's this word paraphotography, which refers to photography that's about photography. So I can't use the word paraphotography. How about periphotography? So something that's on the boundaries of photography. So this is Hiroshi Sugimoto's lightning, one of his lightning fields. And it looks like a regular Silver Jowson print made by some standard abstract process. But instead what has really happened is he's run tens of thousands of volts of electricity through the emulsion. And this is what you see. There's no photographic recording event of information in a pro-photographic scene. In fact, I guess that, well, it's indeterminate. Those patterns are not random, but indeterministic. So that's not technically a photograph, but once we see that what we have here is somebody manipulating the channel conditions that would be the channel conditions normally associated with photography, it kind of makes sense to place it in relation to photography. It's not a photograph, but it's interestingly related to a photograph. Or here's another example, Alison Rossiter. She buys old film stock that has not been exposed. So, ex-hypothesis, no photographic recording event, no photographic scene. It hasn't been exposed. And then she develops it. Okay, this is an example of what you get when you when you don't send your stuff to the lab for 70 years. Looks like that. Kind of amazing. So I'll stop there. I'm looking very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say about this.